They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WEBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax. Joining me today, we have Chuck Welsh. Chuck is a former real estate developer who is currently sitting in the sun in Florida talking to us. Chuck, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sue. I appreciate it.
So you were telling me about how you got into becoming a real estate developer. And I know that we talked yesterday a little bit about your experiences and what you did. So, you know, take us through that.
Sure, I would love to. I was a naval officer up until 1993, and when I got out of the Navy, was looking as to where I was going to start my career, and met a fellow who was a real estate developer here in Florida who needed help with land development management, strictly the construction of infrastructure, streets, roads, curb gutter, stormwater, et cetera, and you know, asked me if I would come work for him, which I did in late 1993. And over the course of the next 6 years, worked for two other national builders developing their residential subdivision sites in Georgia, Florida, and North Carolina.
And so you know what it was like. You know what the policies were and why you had to have HOAs and why you developed HOAs and all of that, right?
Right. It's kind of what led us here. I mean, to where we are today and the evolution that we saw prior even to my coming into the business, but from 1993 up until 2006 and then 2006 and beyond, we were able to watch some pretty dynamic things happen in the home building industry, be it single family residential townhomes or condominiums. The process, which I would love to share with you, that if your average listener would want to know, how did I get into a homeowners association? Why does my neighborhood even have a homeowners association? I wonder if a lot of people even understand or realize it is something that is mandated. And the history of that mandate came about going as far back as to the late 1970s, involving the Water Quality Act.
Actually, it came before that, but I'm going to let you take it from the 70s, and maybe later I'll take us back to the earlier times.
Sure, and I understand, and I know they came about much further, but with regard to one of the primary mandates, it started out with the evolution of the Water Quality Act, that if you drive through a neighborhood or if you're in a residential subdivision, let's say in Atlanta or anywhere like that, not necessarily an urban center, you'll see that there's retention ponds everywhere. Mm-hmm. And those ponds are there not just to view a lake. They're there to serve a physical function in the interest of water quality. And that's brought about primarily twofold. That's reduction of pollutants into main tributaries and rivers and water bodies, and also, interestingly enough, for flood control. And that would be downstream flood control. That came about in the late 70s, early 80s, and the idea behind that was for a certain amount of impervious surface, and I will explain what that is. That's impervious surface is concrete, roof tiles, interestingly enough, even swimming pools. a certain percentage of that is only allowed on so much land to be developed. And once you exceed a certain percentage, based on the water body that the runoff is going into, you're required to have water control devices, water quality control devices, which most people refer to as ponds or retention ponds. And obviously you can't have one pond per home site, you know, on anything less than an acre or three quarters of an acre. So the intent here was to ensure that those water quality devices are collectively maintained by the homeowners or the residential subdivision components that enjoy what they provide for the greater water body that the water ends up flowing into, if that makes sense. And so the mandate required that the homeowners associations had to do it, and it kind of became more mandated on a municipal level, because to record the final plat, and I'll explain what that is, but to record the final plat, it got to be where we also had to incorporate the corporation that would maintain those water quality devices, and that corporation subsequently became the Homeowners Association.
Now, we've seen, I have so many issues with these retention ponds. I have so many issues with where we're going in terms of development in this country and all of the environmental stuff that goes along with it. But the retention ponds, there have been some kids drowning in them. Some of them are beautiful. Some of them have little fountains in them. Some of them, you know, they just look like little man-made lakes. I'm wondering, with all of this extra water that's sitting around, I know you're in Florida.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at one right now.
There's water everywhere in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
There's water absolutely everywhere, but you go out to some place like Arizona or some desert place or some place that doesn't have quite the amount of water, and then all of a sudden you have all these ponds, these artificial ponds and lakes and things. You're actually altering the environment. You're introducing a whole lot of humidity into the air where it's not normally humid. Right?
Right. Well, yeah, but I mean, while I don't have any experience out west, I can tell you I am familiar with the issues surrounding flash flooding. Again, as I said, you know, water control devices are also in place to manage and maintain 100 and 500 year storm events. So, again, they're serving multiple purposes, all coming back to a federal mandate. Now that federal mandate has been, you know, it's been subsidized down to the municipal level, so it's the responsibility of the municipality to see what effect that has on the water bodies that they serve. And I guess that's the best explanation I can give you on why you would see so many out there, because when they do get rain, they tend to have flash flooding.
Yeah, they do, but you know what? It's all evaporated within 5 minutes, because I used to live out in Arizona, and you did. You got these horrendous rains that just poured down for 10 minutes, and 5 minutes later you could see the steam come up, and it was bone dry again. So, I mean, that was the nature of the desert. That's what deserts typically do. I'm concerned about what we're doing. And where we are right now, where I am right now, and I think Florida is also a place where you have a whole lot of development going on. Here we're turning the suburbs into urban areas. Everything is walkable communities. We have no land left.
Sure.
All we have is asphalt and shingles and concrete and sidewalks. In fact, I'm sitting right next to a bunch of almost $1 million. They look like shipping crates standing on their ends with alleys between them, separating them, and their townhouses. And there's absolutely nowhere for the water to go. In fact, we had a huge snowstorm not too long ago. Half the roads are still blocked. Half the lanes are still blocked because they had no place to put the snow. It's just piled high there, and it's not melting, even though we've had some really nice days since then.
Well, you know, Shu, recently, and when I say recently, over the past 20 years, a lot of the retention is now being placed underground. I recently watched a project up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where it's a commercial project that's being put in, and I call it project, call it development. Some people call it whatever your chosen word for it is. But many new developments, including Florida, and when I say new, again, I'm referring to 20 years, have underground retention, where it is a box. It is a large concrete box that sits under the parking lot or underground where the water is going. And then as it rises in that device, there's a spill out, and that spill out ends up taking the water into the main tributary, which ends up going into the main water body. So it's there. It's just that a lot of what you might see might have come about before those were implemented. And if you were to talk to anybody in a stormwater department with any municipality, because stormwater is so serious that, I mean, in a municipality, in public works, you have engineering, you have streets and transportation, and you have stormwater department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and,
I know.
And their guidelines are constantly changing. So as we watch the evolution of this, where you might see, you know, a problem where there is no runoff, that's been the evolution of bringing in underwater retention, which, as you can imagine, is extremely expensive.
I can. Here's another question, and I'm sort of going off the tracks just a little bit, but before I forget, have you ever heard of permeable asphalt?
No, that must be fairly new. I was working my way out of the business in 2006.
Okay, so I first heard about this in 2007. And apparently it's something that's supposed to allow, instead of having all the rainwater just roll off and roll down into the streets or the gutters or the low points, but it's supposed to allow it to drain through the asphalt into the ground, because you want it to go into the ground somehow, right?
Well, it's going to run off regardless. I mean, I'm sure you've heard the term percolation.
Yeah.
When you get into your more higher density clay soils, a lot of which you see in Charlotte up to, and, you know, Raleigh up toward where you are, even further north of there, you have your clay soils. The clay soils don't absorb the water. Now, you come down here to Florida where, you know, a lot of the surface soils are sand, until you go more into the central part of the state, then, you know, you have the ability for the water to be, you know, to soak into the ground, if you will, into the water table. So it depends on the type of soils you have and the location you are.
Okay. So let's get back to, you were developing at some point, you decided to quit doing that, but you had these mandates to develop associations.
Mm-hmm.
Was it something that you guys wanted to do, or?
It was something that was just always commonplace from the minute I went into the business.
So it was just accepted that, you know, when you developed something, it had to be in an association, yes?
Right. That's part of the process. Just to give it to you in brief, some people know what a recorded plat is, some don't. A recorded plat is what allows you to subdivide the property and then sell off the individual pieces, in this case, lots, okay? So let's say you have a 48-acre piece of land or a 40-acre piece of land that you've purchased as a developer, and you want to develop that into 100 home sites. And let's, for now, let's just keep it to single-family residential, and we could get into townhomes and multifamily and condominiums at some point in the future. But let's just say a single-family, standard single-family residential subdivision, $200,000, $150,000 houses. And you would take a 40-acre site, and let's say you could get three houses an acre, so that would be 120 home sites, and you would engineer it, you'd get your approvals, you'd go develop it. But before you could sell off those individual lots to either a builder or convey them to yourself to build a home, you would have to record the plat, which is a legal document, okay? that provides survey information for each individual lot. But to do that in conjunction with recording it, you have to record the covenants, restrictions, bylaws of the association that will maintain the water quality of the site. And what's happened over time is that's come to include maintenance of entrance monuments, maintenance of common spaces, playgrounds, open areas, in Florida, marinas. And so that constitution, if you will, which is called a declaration, is put into place and recorded simultaneously with the final plat that allows you to convey the property. And that's required by the municipality.
The declaration that you're talking about is commonly referred to as the CCNRs.
Correct.
Covenants, conditions, and restrictions. How did you decide on the covenants, which run with the land and affect the single-family homes? And when I talked to you yesterday, you said that you never used a boilerplate. And if I go into the courthouse here and go through the land records, every subdivision built in a certain era will have the same boilerplate set of declarations. I mean, some of them in the old days were just copied over and over again. And you,
it's awful.
Yeah, I mean, they're illegible. They're just, you know, copies from copies from copies, and they're totally illegible. But you said you tried to find a character, or you designed the place based on the character of the subdivision. Could you explain that?
Yeah, I think that came about as a result of good mentorship in the business, because a lot of people I worked for had been around in the 60s and the 70s. While you're always in business to make money, I think there was a different culture 40 years ago, even 50 years ago, on how real estate and land development management were done.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being, each one of these is an individual community. As silly as it sounds, think of them almost like a country. And there are good countries and there are bad countries. And usually the bad countries are the ones that don't have a good constitution. And so, you know, with each one of these associations in recording the CCRs, you know, the intent needed to be to tailor those CCRs. Nobody's got a crystal ball, but to try to tailor those CCRs that serve the best interest of that community, depending on its location, topography. I mean, you're not going to do the same set of CCRs on a beachfront community in Florida that you're going to do, let's say, in Orlando.
Good point.
Or you're not going to do the same set of CCRs in Fairfax, Virginia, that you would do perhaps for something in, you know, Texas, Dallas. So it was very, and that goes all the way down to whether or not they were 5 miles apart, because the topography was different, the streets, the access. Some only have one entryway, some have two, some have three. And all of that needed to be taken into consideration to avoid any potential conflict in the future. And I hate to admit it, but a lot of it had to do with avoiding a lawsuit. I mean, the best way to avoid a lawsuit is to do it right the first time. You know, I knock on wood, and thankfully I was never on the receiving end of a lawsuit as a developer, and that's got to be rare. But with the CCRs, it was to try and tailor those community documents commensurate to the population, number of homes I had there. You wouldn't do the same set of CCRs for a 25-lot subdivision that you would do for a 250 with an amenity center and a pool. So when you see the carbon copies and the Xerox copies going back and forth,
mm-hmm.
and you look at the public records, I think a lot of that came about probably as a result of people getting into a hurry, wanting that plat recorded, wanting to convey immediately because of interest carry, bring in the money. And when speculation hit the market in 2000, shortly after 9/11, in that time period, you saw it get real sloppy, very, very sloppy. And I watched that happen.
I got to tell you, before we go on, I've got to tell you a funny story. When you said, you reminded me of, when you said you wanted to avoid, or a lot of developers wanted to avoid a lawsuit. There was a developer out in California, oh gosh, I don't know, about 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, who developed a property, and he had a covenant in there, and it was an exclusionary covenant. And he said, no lawyers allowed. He would not allow a lawyer to buy into his development. And a lawyer came along and decided he wanted to buy a house. And when they found out he was an attorney, they said, sorry, you know, we have a covenant that says you can't be there. So the lawyer sued them and took them to court and said, hey, they can't do this. It's discrimination. And the judge said, you're not a protected class. Yes, they can.
Right.
So he exactly. upheld that covenant. And, you know, so, yeah, a lot of developers don't want attorneys in there.
Oh, well, listen, I look back to this day and think of all kinds of clever things that I could have put into deed restrictions and covenants and restrictions that would have made it very entertaining to this day. But at the end of the day, what I was simply trying to do, and I mentioned to you last night about holding the meetings and the inception and the birth of the Homeowners Association meeting and how that came to pass. And I'd like to get into that if I could, but,
you know,
again, what I was trying to do with the covenants and restrictions, okay, the declaration, covenants, restrictions, and bylaws, CCRs, was in the interest of what I believe to be the future of the welfare of the community so that these people could enjoy appreciation in their homes. Mine wasn't to tell them what color drapes to put in their window. It wasn't to say all grass must be cut at 2 3/4 inches. None of that stuff. Okay. It was just those basic, it's kind of, I don't mean to be philosophical here, but I used the word constitution earlier.
Yeah.
So our constitution is a great document. It's allowed to be amended from time to time. And that was a great mechanism that was put into place. And I understand that a lot of our laws have gotten complex, but the basic Bill of Rights still exists. And that was the way I saw it is, look, give them a foundation. People will be living here. As morbid as it sounds, I mean, I would build these subdivisions and walk away from them. And I hate to use the word subdivision, but these communities. And I would walk away from them somewhat proud, thinking, you know, one day these trees that I've planted that are maybe 4 inches wide right now and cost $500 a piece, and they're these little oak trees, okay, I'm going to bring my daughter or my grandchildren back one day, and these streets are going to be tree-lined, okay? These trees are going to grow up real big and strong, and this is going to be nice and shady because, unfortunately, I had to cut a tree or two down to achieve development. So the idea was to always replace, knowing that, you know, it's not going to happen in a year, but I'm going to come back here 20, 30 years from now, and this is going to look really good. I mean, we've thought about our curves in the streets. We thought about what we were able to save and couldn't save. With the indigenous landscape. And, I always walked away from going, hey, I want to come back here one day and look at this and be proud of it. And aside from making the money, I mean, yeah, everybody wants to make money. But for me, there was a little bit of a, hey, I just altered the landscape. I just changed the planet. And I just housed 120 people who don't know each other. So, you know, I mean, my objectives here are multifold. I want to see them get along. And I want to see this. I want to come back one day and I want to go, this was a good thing I did. And it didn't have to be $800,000 houses, shoot. I mean, you can do it for middle-class America. We did it for a long time after World War II. And for some reason, we're seeing that diminish in the interest, I don't want to say in the interest of profit, because you've got to make the profit. But I think maybe better put the interest of the quick buck.
I find it very interesting that you refer to the covenants as a Bill of Rights. And I think that I think you're onto something there. Because, you know, CC&Rs, covenants, conditions, restrictions, it's such a negative turn of phrase. It's covenants run with the land, they're conditions on where you go, you know, being allowed to live here, and restrictions on your free use of your property. But you're talking about a Bill of Rights. And in those covenants, you also have a list of your rights.
You should.
You should.
Certainly.
You should. And I think it's interesting that, and I'm sort of thinking in terms of the Bill of Rights and the covenants, and I think that's an interesting phrase there. The other thing that that I was thinking of was in the old days, back in, oh, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, they would put in the covenants at the top of the Declaration that the reason for this association is to protect property values.
Yeah, I think they missed it.
They missed it by a mile. But my friend actually lived in a condominium, and he looked at his declaration one day, and he said, okay, so if the purpose of this association is to protect my property values, dear association, please tell me what you have done to protect my property values and how my values compare to the values of the property in across the street in another subdivision. Can you give us that? And they just went nuts.
Well, I would also ask to define the word value, because in many people's eyes, value is enjoyment, not dollars.
I agree.
So, you know, when you're talking to me about maintaining my value, to one person they see value as, hey, I want to roll out of this thing in 4 years and I want to make 12%. The other person saying, I want to live here for the rest of my life and enjoy it. That's my value. The coining the term or using the term American dream may sound silly, but isn't that what this was all about after World War II?
Mm-hmm.
So, with that said, and with the interest of rights in mind, that was what I did when I had sold, let's say I went into in year one, I went into the development of a piece of property, and by year two, we were selling houses. And by year three, we were at 50% occupancy. Okay, and I'm just using that as an example. There was a mechanism in the CCRs for me to turn that association over to the homeowners. Okay, I would hold meetings. I was the declarant. I was the president of the homeowners association for anywhere between 2 and, in some cases, 4 years. I was the president. And we held quarterly or semi-annual or annual meetings. And I conducted them by the numbers. And in the initial meeting that I would hold, which would be, we'd have maybe 20% filled. I can't remember the exact numbers where we would be on percentage, where we would actually initiate the first homeowners association meeting. But I mentioned this to you last night. I would get with the county sheriff, be it Wake County, Durham County, Duval County, Cobb County, and I would try to get an off-duty officer where I would pay him. I mean, technically, even though I'd set up the association, I was putting more money into the association at that time than the homeowners. And, you know, I could have been cheap and said, I don't want to, you know, pay a peace officer $200 or $300 on his off time. But I thought it was a good way to start, because all courtrooms have a bailiff. Congress has a sergeant at arms. There's always somebody there to say, you know, that's a third party, that's objective, I don't want to say law enforcement. That's too stern of a word. But just that person there that would kind of, everybody says, okay, here he is. And I would always try to get the same one for every meeting. And I would get to know him personally or her, sorry, him or her personally, because many times we did have female officers. And it's interesting as I look back and have gone back to some of these communities where that officer still comes to every homeowners association meeting and even makes a point to patrol the neighborhood, because they've become friends and acquaintances with the members of that community. And I thought it was, and I didn't make that up. I mean, that was something that was passed on to me from a mentor. But it worked really well and continues to work really well to this day. I know we're in an era in our country where there's divided opinions on peace officers, and we hear the bad stories and we hear the good stories. But, you know, in my belief, I didn't see it as law enforcement as much as I saw it as a sergeant at arms. And that was another thing that set us off on the right tone. Okay, nobody came to the first meeting with a grievance. So at the first meeting, you know, I had them there. And so if a grievance did ever come to pass, which I'm not aware of any, I'm sure down the road some may have, but it was nice to know that people can remain civil, because I think with a peace officer in the meeting, they're going to tend to remain civil. They can have their disputes. You know, they can have their disagreements. That's the American way. But I do hear really bad stories, especially down here in Florida. I mean, literally people going across the table at each other.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever in your career, have you ever had an association where the homeowners said they refuse to take over the association? They don't want it.
No, but I've heard of that. No, I think that had a lot to do with the demographic that I built in, which I'll just refer to simply as Middle America. I think where I was building, and the need that I wasn't trying to do anything fancy. The need I was trying to satisfy was a 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath home with a 2-car garage. And those people have jobs, and they have their lives and their kids, and they care about the schools, and they care about the traffic. And at the end of the day, they understood that we had to turn it over to them. And what I had to be careful of is who I turned it over to. I was always very cognizant of the people who seemed eager to get on the board. So, but no, I never had an experience where they didn't want to take it.
Well, I got a call some years ago from some people further in Virginia, in Northern Virginia, about an hour and a half drive from where I am right now. And it was a small subdivision, very small subdivision, with, maybe 15, 20, 25 houses, somewhere in that neighborhood. And the developer had finished, and the developer wanted to turn it over to the homeowners, and the homeowners refused to accept it. They just flat out didn't want it. And so they called me, and I said, well, it must have been, it was while I was doing the show. So it must have been about 15 years ago. So I went down to a meeting that the developer had arranged, and I looked at their governing documents, and I said, all right, you're all here, everyone except one homeowner who was on business travel. I said, you're all here. According to your documents, you can extinguish the HOA, so vote to do that and do away with it. All they had was a street that was going into VDOT, and they weren't going to maintain it, and they had a retention pond. The county wants the retention pond, give it to the county. VDOT, make sure VDOT takes over the street, make sure it's built up to specs, and dissolve the HOA. The representative from the developer was sitting there, and I thought her jaw was going to bounce off the floor when I said that. She said, oh, you can't do that.
Right.
But there was nothing there, Chuck. There was nothing there.
Nothing to maintain.
There was no reason to have the association.
And did it dissolve?
I have no idea. But I said, you're all friends here. And you'll never have this many homeowners at a meeting again, except for one homeowner who was away. Every other homeowner was there. They were all friends. They were all getting along really well together. I said, don't ruin that by having an HOA.
Well, that's unique, because I know in my most recent experience here in Florida, it was actually divided, which created a lot of discourse, was that there, myself included, because of my experience, wanted a developer off the board to give the homeowners control. And he had gone well beyond what the law allowed for him to continue to maintain control of that corporation. Because at the end of the day, let's remember, these are corporations. We call them associations. We call them what we will. But in Florida, nonprofit corporations are under Florida Statute 619. Okay, and the rules of a nonprofit corporation are dictated by that. And he seemed to have a strong desire to remain on the board, which a number of us disagreed with, but not to go off necessarily in that direction. But I think, Shu, and you mentioned 15 years ago when this happened, I don't know where you really began seeing the problems with HOAs that seem to have come to light just, you know, so commonly now, but I think this is kind of a new thing here. And I mentioned to you last night why I think that came about. May I talk to you about that for a second?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We're just exploring this phenomenon today. We have no set goal, no nothing. We're just going to chat.
Well, here's the thing. And I've done a little bit of digging in this, and this kind of comes to, you hadn't asked me yet why I got out of the business. And I'm not going to say that I got out of the business without the intent of ever going back in, but the longer I stay out of it, and when I say stay out of it, what I'm referring to is, you know, the acquisition of land, the development of single family residential subdivisions and their ultimate sale. As more time goes by, I see myself less and less likely of going back there, but it was this decision that I made, in late 2005, early 2006, that it was time to get out of the business. And as I look back on that now, and as I read a lot of things, to include what you've put up and a number of other people around the country, we seem to have a real problem right now, or at least it seems to be a groundswell of a problem regarding homeowners associations that I certainly, in the mid-90s, in the business, had heard nothing of. It just, maybe it's the internet, I don't know, but I didn't come across a lot of HOA, major HOA issues that you see now. And I mean criminal activity on the part of boards and management companies and monetary issues and problems that you see neighbors having with each other. And it seems to be becoming much more prevalent right now. And I don't know if it's going to continue to get worse, but I've got some suspicions on how this came about, if I'm in fact right, that, you know, I just didn't see this problem 20 years ago, where you go into YouTube, like I said, and you see neighbors fighting with each other. And I've heard stories, horror stories. One of my favorite, and I won't name him, is a country music star whose father decided to go after the HOA board president of his neighborhood with a golf club in Tennessee. That made some news recently, and I thought that was humorous. This country music singer's father had just had enough of being told what to do, and he was chasing the HOA board president down the street with a two iron. So it's gotten a little comical, and I think I might know what got us here, and it kind of coincides with why I got out of the business. And I'd just like to talk about that briefly, if I could. In the, as I'm sure you know, and it's pretty common knowledge, through the 60s, 70s, even with the interest rate problems in the early 80s, but into the 80s, the 90s, it was, you buy a house, it's going to go up in value. It just is. It was always that guaranteed 3-5%. It was the smartest thing you could ever do is to be a homeowner. It was like a no-brainer. I guess that sort of mushroomed in the mid to late 90s. And then certainly, as I'm sure you're well aware, the massive reduction in the interest rates after 9/11, we just saw this explosion in housing. And I actually sent you a chart last night on an email that shows our sales of new single-family homes over the past 4 years. And where in 2000 we were in a recession, we were in a small recession, and you know, based on how that chart had run on the sales of homes, you would have expected homes to go, the sale of homes to actually go down, and yet we were in a recession and home sales spiked, and they didn't stop. And 9/11 may have proliferated this, because money became very easy. It was either easy to get for developers to develop land or easy to get for home buyers to buy homes. And speculation became rampant. And I guess good for me in my mid-30s, because I was a benefactor of this. It was a good time. But something happened in 2005 that made me very, very uncomfortable. And I wanted to share this with you because I think it's what led us to the problem. I'm sitting here looking at some notes I took, and Ben Bernanke, on March 8th of 2005, was at the Executives Club of Chicago and gave a speech. And somehow, right after that, I got a hold of this, and I read it. And he, in that speech, sent out some warning signals with regarding the housing industry. And he was talking about the economy, and I think we can all agree Ben Bernanke's a pretty smart fellow.
Mm-hmm.
But he was throwing up some caution lights. He said, the economy's great. We've come out of the recession in 2000, 2001, the dot-com bubble. Everything looks good, but I don't like the debt. We are acquiring a lot of debt, and a lot of this debt is in housing. And I don't think we'll ever see a year again like 2004. Well, this was my career. And, you know, I'm reading the Federal Reserve Chairman pretty much tell me I will never have another year again in my life as good as 2004. And with as much respect as I have for, well, he wasn't Federal Reserve Chairman at the time. I'm sorry. He was, he didn't get confirmed until about 14 months later. But nevertheless, and of course, you know, he succeeded Alan Greenspan. But I mean, you know, I've got this very intelligent man telling me I've just had the best year of my life and it's pretty much over. You know, stabilize, plateau. But then about a year later, after he'd been confirmed, he used the word, I believe that the U.S. housing industry is due for a soft landing. Well, when the Federal Reserve Chairman says soft landing, what he's saying is buckle your seatbelt. Put up your tray table.
We're
put
landing.
Your head between your knees. Because the federal, that's a nice way of the Federal Reserve Chairman saying fire in the theater. Okay. and he turned out to be right. I did my homework on it. And at that point in time, I suspended any interest in the acquisition of land and, believe it or not, started discounting lots in 2006 to builders, which a lot of people would say 2006. Oh my God, that was the height. And I said, no, I'm going to discount lots to try to help my builders accelerate their sales to get through these subdivisions, and I'm not looking at anything else. And by the end of 2007, early 2008, I was completely out. I had sold everything. I no longer had any land interests or real estate interests, and then was very disappointed to see what happened in September of 2008, and it was terrible. And I think we still reel from it today. But that brings us to these HOA problems that I think we're seeing. Because in that time period where we had so much speculation, especially here in Florida, and we talked about the, you know, boilerplate CCRs and just this hurry, 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 let's get it closed. What we've got now is communities, residential communities that ended up distressed, ended up with a large number of foreclosures, ended up with people who did not care, ended up with people who saw the board as a personal opportunity.
Yeah.
And took advantage of that. Now, again, if we were to go back to the old days and somebody had been in there for 3 or 4 years and had, you know, received 5 or 6% appreciation or even 3, over a four-year period, they'd say, look, I'm not happy anymore. I don't like the way this is being run. I'm going to put a for sale sign out front, and my wife and kids and I are going to move, and we're going to go somewhere else. And I know that occurred. You know, we had time periods in the 70s and 80s where people transferred a lot. And you may remember the days when a company used to buy your house.
Yeah.
Because they saw it as a no miss.
Yeah.
Sure, we need to transfer you from Atlanta to Chicago, and don't worry about your house in Cobb County. We'll buy it.
Yeah.
So, but those days are long gone. And so what you've got is you've got people, I've heard the word, literally heard the word, Shu, I'm stuck.
Mm-hmm.
I'm stuck.
Oh,
I'm stuck here.
Oh, I know. They're upside down. They're stuck. They're going into foreclosure. You know, all the problems that we've heard about, I hear about them all the time. As you can imagine, I hear from people. They write to me, they email me, they, you know,
It's just unbelievable what's happening.
Right, and there's no escape. Okay, so we look at our three basic needs, food, clothing, and shelter, okay? And of the value, as in dollars, okay, not enjoyment, but as in dollars, of the cost of those three, the greatest you'll ever spend in your entire life is the shelter for those who have bought a home.
Mm-hmm.
So the banks don't care. I mean, why would they? It's not a bank's job to care. It's a bank's job to make money.
Right.
So the bank doesn't care.
Well said. Right.
Well, and that's what banks have always, that's been
But a lot of people just don't see that, you know. They think, the banks will sell you, will give you a mortgage, and they'll turn around and sell it on the secondary market. They're out of there. They've made their money.
Right. That's their job. I mean, I think about my home that I built, interestingly enough, and I would never recommend this to any developer, but I did, and I survived it, and it was successful. But I built my home in North Carolina in a subdivision that I developed. And for the first couple of years, you know, there'd be a knock on my door. I mean, at 9 o'clock at night, oh, you know, I've got a puddle of water in my backyard. wait a minute, I'm your neighbor now. If you want to deal with this, call me tomorrow at work. But I'm glad I did it. It was, you know, it was beneficial to me, and geographically it helped me because it was, you know, it was a large part of my day, and
yeah,
it helped being there. So, and I still have that home to this day, and I, you know, and I think about, you know, the mortgage that I put in place and, you know, what it's cost me. But look, that's the job of the bank. So I don't have any issue there. But where we do come into the issue is the emotion, the level of emotion these homeowners are going through, okay, who are in a situation,
yes,
where they might be in a building or a neighborhood where the banks aren't lending anything less than, let's say, 50% loan to value, okay, because of the, and there's, and those distressed communities are still out there, regardless of anybody wants to tell you.
Oh, yeah, no, they are.
Right, and so they're not mowing the grass, they're not doing this, the maintenance isn't being taken care of, they fired the security guard, and that brings us into the whole other issue of private streets and private maintenance. But, and so, you know, they're there, and they're stuck, and suddenly, for some reason or another, be it appropriation of funds, be it, you know, a conflict of interest or opinion. And my favorite one is disparate interests, because that's what we got into 15 years ago, was offering the tennis club or offering the marina. But, you know, everybody's not required to be a part of it, okay? Just certain people who want to pay extra. But they pay extra, and then they don't have any governance over that entity. Only the board governs that entity, even though all of the members of the board may not have any interest in it. So, and that just keeps coming up time and time again, especially in Florida, where amenities are so important. So here they are. They're stuck. They paid $600,000 for something 12 years ago that's worth $300 or maybe $350 today. Even if they put 10 or 20% down, shoe, they've got to write a check,
yeah,
to sell, to leave.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, if you've got the money to do it, it's still a painful pill to swallow. Why did I just invest the last 12 years of my life? I cannot live here anymore based on the way this association is being run. So I want to leave, but I've got to write the check.
Yep. They're upside down. You said earlier you don't know how long this has been going on. It's not recent. It goes back a very long time, almost to the beginning of these mass-produced HOAs. The reason you didn't hear about them so much was because the reporters, the local media, did not want to cover them because they had real estate ads and things, and they did not want to offend their advertisers. So a lot of that was not reported. Also, a lot of the homeowners were embarrassed. They thought they had done something wrong, so they didn't want to say anything. They didn't want their family to know that they were having problems. And then when you ended up with the internet, and I started doing this back in the 80s. So this is how, and I did not have a problem with my HOA, but this is how far back I went. And when we found people through court records and said, hey, you know, you want to join us, they were really upset that we had discovered them. They did not want anyone to know that they had had problems with their HOAs. So it was a mark of you know, embarrassment there. Then once you ended up with the internet and once you ended up with the ability to communicate, then you no longer relied on the media. Then you no longer relied on anything else. Then people realized it wasn't just them. It was a lot of people, and that's when you started to see all of the stories coming out.
Right, and I'm going to pick that up from right there and tell you, civil law was invented to keep us civil. You know, a lot of people talk about, well, I don't want to be one of those people that's thought of as a sewer. Well, our system was set up and designed that civil law was meant to keep us civil and solve these problems. So what I would say to anybody who's having a problem with their homeowners association, and this is a topic for another show, because just identifying an attorney to help you is a laborious process. But that's what civil law is there for. It's there to fix the problem. It's there to keep us civil. It's there to keep a country music singer's father from chasing a guy down a street with a two iron. Okay.
Oh, I think it's much more fun to chase a guy down the street with a two iron.
Well, it is, but unfortunately, he was arrested. Okay. So his I'm not going to name the country singer, but his dad's mugshot is on the internet. So, you know, and yet still, some mugshots make for a great and funny story. I mean, it's, you know. But civil law was put there to keep us civil. Okay. Now, let me expound on that. Shu, nobody goes to bed at night with a box of money under their bed labeled lawyer money in case my homeowners association decides to ruin my life.
Maybe they should, huh?
Well, if they could find the money. And it's almost too bad there's not an insurance policy you can buy. And then people are very reluctant to sue their HOA.
Yeah.
To try to straighten things out, because they then become, or their fear is they will become a pariah in their community. Oh, you just took our internal affairs and made them public for the courts. Okay. And you'll never be able to peacefully live there again. So, but that's a double-edged sword. Okay. Because it depends on what you're willing to sacrifice to see the right thing done. And that goes back to these boilerplate CCRs that were never written correctly in the first place. CCRs that, for one reason or another, may deny you the right of due process, okay? May deny you the ability to peacefully live in your home, okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, it's hard to say I got the money because I don't have the money, or I don't want to live there and sue them. But here's the thing, and you touched on it just a second ago about people being embarrassed or ashamed.
Yeah.
Okay, and then we go back to this issue of protecting property value. Okay, the more cases that come to light to try to solve this problem, and the more they are publicized, either on the internet or Channel 10 News, okay, these HOA boards have to answer to those owners, and those owners are going to want to know, why were we on the news last night? Because no real estate agent, I've got my place for sale, and no real estate agent will now touch my place with a 10-foot pole.
Right.
So if you're talking about maintaining property values and you're talking about money, the last thing you want to do as a homeowners association is discriminate, disparage, target. Everybody has an equal voice. And those rights need to be maintained. And that takes us back to where we said it's like a Bill of Rights. And it's got to be protected. But all too often, these board members get on these boards with their own agenda.
That's true. You know what? We are out of time, Chuck. Can you believe it?
We can do it again.
We can?
Absolutely, Shu.
Okay. I know that you've got a lot more to say. So, yeah, we'll plan on having you back again sometime. But right now, I want to thank you a whole lot for taking time out, sitting in the sun, and talking to us.
Thank you so much, Shu. I really appreciate it. And I want you to warm up there soon.
Oh, we will. It'll come. Spring will be here. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.